We are very happy to tap into some of that wisdom and knowledge today. And with that, I would like to introduce our guest.
Thank you, Amar. Assalamu alaikum. And bienvenue. Ministers and representatives of government, academics, teachers, students, and others. Thank you very much for that warm welcome. Thank you very much to the Thalassa Hotel for a very comfortable stay and wonderful accommodation. And thank you to all of you Tunisians, because I have been made to feel very welcome here from the moment I arrived. Thank you. Now I want you to listen very carefully, because what I'm going to tell you today has not been published. It is the result of a lot of research. I have a printed paper, and I have made these copies of the printed paper available. Unfortunately, I'm not allowed to distribute this in electronic form at this stage, but printed copies are available from the organizers. So just listen very carefully, please. So next slide. Thank you. So I went on a little tour of Tunis yesterday. I think we've lost the microphone for working. So a couple of thousand years ago, this was world-leading technology. Have a look at it. How would you go about making these today with the kind of tools and equipment that was available at that time? I don't think any of you will be able to answer that question. What it shows is two things. First of all, people in Tunisia can lead the world with technology. Secondly, that technology can be lost, can be forgotten. Right? So we need to think very carefully about why that technology has been lost. For example, if you go to Lebanon, you will find similar evidence of technology, which came a little later, about 500 years later, when the diameter of these columns was 2 meters and the length was 18 meters. And those columns are still standing today in a zone which has numerous earthquakes. Right? We still do not know how they managed to make blocks of stone weighing 2,000 tons and position them within an accuracy of 3 millimeters. And they're still in position today. Right? Lots of technology has been lost. But the point is this, that as engineers, you have a great future in front of you. But one of the difficulties is that most of what you need is not taught in engineering schools today. Now, I taught engineering for several years. Let me give you a few slides to explain some of my background. Next slide. So again, this is the outline of my talk, so I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about where I've come from. Next. This is a robot which shears sheep. We have about 170 million sheep in Australia, a lot more sheep than people, and shearing the wool off is a major job that has to be done every year. And the wool industry were desperate to find any means of getting a wool off sheep that did not rely on manual shearers. Not because they wanted to build robots, they simply wanted the shearers to behave and not charge exorbitant rates. Next. Then I discovered that there was a major issue in the world, unexploded ordnance, landmines, affecting something like 70, 80 countries and many countries in this part of the world. The question was how to remove this problem and to allow normal human development, and I found myself working in countries like Cambodia, Pakistan. I've never been to Afghanistan, which is where these mines are a problem, but I know that the mines are a problem in this part of the world too. And that brought me face to face with some rather interesting issues. Next. So this is a photograph of an outlying area of Islamabad in Pakistan, only 20 kilometers from the seat of government at the time. Now it's got a few more houses. And you will see there a brand new mobile phone tower. And yet, the water supply in this area was not working. Now I'm told that even in this country today, that water that is safe to drink is not necessarily available by pipe to people's homes. So this most fundamental technology is something that eludes us in many parts of the world. But why would one of the oldest technologies be not possible, water supply, when brand new mobile phones work extraordinarily well? Pakistan has some of the lowest access charges for mobile phone use and some of the highest use per capita in the world. It's amazing. Next. And this led me on to my own entrepreneurship. You see, actually I'm going to tell you a very different message today. I'm going to tell you that you don't have to be an entrepreneur to succeed in engineering. But I found myself in a position of being a young entrepreneur. I'm not joking. I am a very new entrepreneur. I'm very new to this business. But I realized that there was tremendous potential for energy efficient cooling around the world. And so my experiences in Pakistan led me to develop an air conditioning technology, which we're now actually selling in Pakistan, India, and Australia. Just at the very beginning, just in small numbers. So I speak from experience as an entrepreneur, as a business person, as well as an engineering educator for something like 40 years. And through all that time, I have been practicing as an engineer. And what I learned as I started to teach engineering is that the way we teach engineering has very little to do with the way we practice it. And this is a major, major issue around the world. And something which I plan to address in today's talk, but maybe indirectly. Let me continue. Next slide. So that tells you a little bit about my background. There's some challenges which I've seen in Pakistan, and from the little I've seen of Tunisia, many of these challenges exist here too. So first of all, engineers pay. Engineers typically get paid in Pakistan between a quarter and a third of the rate that they would be paid for similar work in a country like the US or Europe. There's a very low level of capital investment, and I can see the evidence of that here in Tunisia. Foreign engineers tend to get the big contracts. If you build a highway or a bridge, I guess in this country, most of the engineers leading that will be French engineers. Maybe some of them would have originally come from Tunisia, but they will be foreign engineers. And many engineers tend to migrate to other countries. In the case of Pakistan, US, and here where we're talking about links with US and Canada, there is an agenda here. There's an agenda here that you have to leave the country in order to succeed. I want to put that to rest here and now. I want you to forget about this idea. It is a very disturbing idea. It is a very tempting idea, but it is incorrect. And my research shows that it's incorrect. Then finally, the high cost of engineered services. Why is it that there's not a motor vehicle manufacturing operation in Tunisia? Why? Because it's more expensive. Why is it that companies struggle with motor vehicle manufacturing in India, in Pakistan? The motor vehicle manufacturing in so many countries requires enormous subsidies from governments. Because it is more expensive than it is in Germany. Mercedes-Benz cars get built in Germany because it's cheaper to build them there. There is this idea that because labor appears to be cheap in countries like Tunisia, in Pakistan, India, and China, that necessarily it is cheaper to manufacture. What I can tell you from my own experience is that this is an illusion. This is an illusion. The question you need to ask is, what does it cost to get a result of comparable quality, durability, and design? And the answer is that generally speaking, it is cheaper in countries like Australia, America, Canada, France, and Germany than it is in a country like Tunisia. That's surprising, right? Let me give you some simple examples. Next. So I'm going to address this issue. What's different in engineering between Paris and Tunis? Now, that's not the question I addressed in my research. The question I addressed in my research is what's different between Perth in Australia, where I live, and Peshawar in Pakistan, or Pune in India.
because I was employing engineers in Islamabad in Pakistan. They were bright engineers. They were clever, intelligent, well-educated in foreign universities and local universities. I knew that their technical capacity was just as good as engineers in Australia. Yet, they could not provide results which I took for granted, having employed many engineers in Australia. I know what engineers in Australia can produce. And yet, it was a puzzle to me that similarly educated engineers, engineering education is almost standard around the whole world. It puzzled me that similarly educated engineers could not produce similar results in Pakistan, nor India, nor other developing countries. In order to answer that question, I have to address some issues in economics, and then I'll talk about value and value creation, which is the latest area of my research. So next. So here we have a picture of people carrying water in Pakistan. And when you look at all the costs involved, most of the cost is actually the unpaid costs of labor, women's labor in this case, and children's labor, carrying the water. When you evaluate that using standard economic models and say, how much does that water cost per ton? Next. There's the answer, $30 to $50 per ton. Right, next. Here's water being delivered in Hyderabad in India. This is very near the center of the city. And if you evaluate the cost of delivering that water, next, $70 to $130 per ton. Next. This is a picture, well, it's a rather sort of synthesized picture of my kitchen tap in Perth in Australia. And the cost of water to me in Australia, next, $3 a ton. $3 a ton, including the cost of the tap. Now, there's something very wrong here, isn't there? Because the poorest people in the most difficult circumstances are paying an enormous amount more for safe drinking water without which nobody can survive. Right? This is an illustration of why costs are very deceptive. This partly explains why costs are very high in a country like Tunisia. And yet, water supply is the job of engineers, surely. Who else is responsible for water supply other than engineers? So this shows you a massive failure of engineering, a massive failure. And it has nothing to do with Silicon Valley, IT, or whatever. This is fundamental technology and it is not working. Next. Energy supplies. So in Pakistan and India, energy is not available at the flick of a switch. In fact, you say, Alhamdulillah, if you turn on the switch and the light comes on. Because the power is off for half or a third of the time. And so consequently, in order to provide continuous power, you need generators or batteries, you have a lot of equipment damage, and a lot of process discontinuities. The result is much higher real costs of energy. So industrial suppliers in Pakistan tell me that their real... Can we get these lights turned off at the front, please? It's very disturbing, because I can't see you and I think you can't see me from time to time. The real cost of energy is typically at least twice for large consumers of what they face in Europe. Next. And here's electricity distribution in Pakistan, next. And this is a challenge from the University Vice Chancellor. We must have trained around 300,000 electrical engineers in Pakistan and India. Yet, load shedding and blackouts are more frequent every year, here 50% of the time. The more engineers we train, the worse the problem gets. This is a failure of engineering education. Next part. Okay, let's go on. Next. So now I'm going to address theory. Now, some of you may get very bored with theory, but I'm going to keep it very simple, and I want this to exercise your thinking. You're all very bright people, that's why you're here. So you can handle a bit of theory, and to my political friends, please be patient. I think even you will be able to understand. Next. So this is the theory that underlies engineering. as articulated by somebody I've met, Billy Cohen, the engineering method is often called design, is the use of heuristics to cause the best change in an uncertain situation within the available resources. Another word for this is problem solving. But I think that I presented you with enough evidence to say that this is not enough. This approach to engineering, based on scientific problem solving, is not providing results. Yes, in certain limited areas, we've got smartphones, we've sent people to the moon. Yeah, we can do some interesting things, but it is not addressing the needs of the vast majority of the world's population. We need to think again. Next. Now, I would argue that theory shapes a discipline. Whatever theories you learn in your education shape the way that you think as a practitioner, as an engineer. So at university, what is it that you learn to do? You learn to write mathematical solutions. If you can please go back. Go back, please. One, thank you. You learn to write mathematical solutions for narrowly defined analytical problems in examinations. Nothing else gets you marks. Nothing else gets you the grades that you need to succeed. Now what happens? Next. This picture tries to capture the situation that many young engineers face themselves. On the left-hand side, there is a steep ramp. That's the process of university education. It's hard work. You jump off the end into your first job and you land heavily on your backside, scratching your head saying, this was not what I was expecting. And many young engineers stay there and they hit their heads against the wall because they learn that, for example, I am stuck in a job and I'm not using anything that I was taught at university. I cannot do what I was trained to do. I cannot use my technical knowledge here. In Tunisia, I'm stuck in a boring government job, and I'm telling clerks what to do, and I'm not achieving anything useful. In fact, everything is getting worse around me. Right? This is the kind of experience that is common to engineers everywhere. It is, you're not unique to Tunisia. For example, a young civil engineer came to me in Australia, working on a major project, and he said, I'm not doing any engineering work in my job. All I do is I drive around and I look at culverts. This is the passage underneath the road where water flows when it rains. And I have to check that the water flows in the right direction. What kind of an engineering job is that? Could be done by a clerk. And I said, well, actually, we forgot to tell you that that is an important part of engineering. Why? Because as an engineer, you'll be responsible for spending a great deal of money, other people's money. And if the job has not been done correctly by contractors, you have to check before they get paid. Once the contractor is paid, they will never come back and fix it if it's wrong. So before you pay the contractor, make sure that what they did is correct. Make sure it's what was specified and agreed. Right? It's a fundamental part of engineering. But you never get taught that in engineering school. Right? So this is symptomatic of the issue. Next. So, well, what about the differences between parrots and tunas? What do you think they are? Suggestions? Opportunities. Fewer opportunities here? Wrong. Next.
Internet coverage.
Huh?
Wi-Fi.
You know, I've been around the world the last couple of weeks. I've been in the US, I've been in London, I've been in Amsterdam, and I can tell you that the internet coverage in all the places I have been is pathetic compared with Pakistan. Pathetic. Pakistan has a really good mobile telecommunications system. You can be up in the Karakoram Mountains, there's no water supply, no clean water, but I can use my smartphone and get 4G access to the internet. All right? Do not automatically think that the opportunities are better in Paris. This is a big mistake. But the answer is, of course, we didn't know. At least 15 years ago, I had no idea. I knew there was a difference, but nobody could explain to me what it was. Next. So that started what was completely unexpected to me, a fascinating research journey. Comparing engineering practice in India, Australia, and Pakistan. 15 years of research by 25 contributors, 330 engineering interviews, 10 field studies, surveys, and the result was that we began to understand, perhaps for the first time, the nature of engineering practice. It was a great surprise, but it was a gradual surprise. You have to understand that it took years before we finally worked out that nobody had described what engineers really do. It just didn't exist. The knowledge didn't exist anywhere of what engineers actually do in their day-to-day work. It had always been taken for granted that engineers do design and problem solving, but actually it turns out that very few engineers do any design. And engineers, even in America and Canada, very rarely solve problems. Why? Because it's much easier to try and find somebody else who solved the problem before. Why reinvent the wheel? The challenge is to find that person. Next. So what do engineers do in their first job? These are Australian engineers 9 months out from graduation. Calculation, modeling, discipline-specific technical work. This is what they report to us. So what that tells you is around most engineers reported that they were doing technical work for less than 10% of their time. Less than 10%. Next. What they did tell us is that they were spending a lot of time on social interactions, talking with each other. And the biggest surprise from this work is that this pattern does not change with experience. Even I, as an experienced engineer, I had this idea that as you get more senior in engineering, you would spend less time on technical work and more time on face-to-face, written, email, telephone interactions with other people. It does not change. It does not change with the level of your career. This was a fascinating result and very puzzling. Next. So, I'm going to summarize here a lot of work that is presented in my book, and I'll talk later about that book. So this is a very simple model of what we observe engineers doing. The first step is, top left, is to identify client and society needs. The next is to conceive a way of meeting those needs. It doesn't mean inventing anything new. It may mean looking up the solution in a few catalogs, or simply looking to see what's been done before. The next is a very important step, and that is predicting the future. You conceive of a solution, you predict how well it's going to work, not only from a technical point of view, but also from a commercial point of view. How much money will it cost to maintain? How long will it last? And what follows then is hopefully a decision to invest a lot of money actually building it. And then the really hard work comes on, because the bottom part, you actually have to deliver on the promises that you make as an engineer. You have to deliver the predicted future on time with predicted cost, performance, safety, and environmental impact. That is very, very difficult. Why is it difficult? Next. You see the X's. They're the bits that we don't teach. The only bits we teach, a little bit about conceiving the future, we call that design, and it's usually a very small part of most engineering programs. And we talk a bit about predicting the future, we call that analysis. You know, your equations, your mathematics, computer modeling, simulation, things like that, comes in handy for that bit. But the rest, it's not addressed at all. So no wonder engineers are appalling at delivering results. Everywhere. Not just here in Tunisia. You know, I've spoken to government ministers like yourselves. And I say, what is your opinion of engineers? The response, engineers are some of the worst people in the world. We give them billions of dollars. And they give us a heap of junk. That is a quote from Pakistan Prime Minister. right? Engineers have a very low reputation in government. They have an equally low reputation in private industry. So one of our biggest companies in Australia that depends on engineering, the CEO told me, I am sick and tired of engineers. Whenever I find an engineer in my organization, I sack that person on the spot. Right? That is our reputation. Why? Let's go on. There's a very simple binary model of engineering that I want to introduce to you. And it is derived from that slightly more complex model. The first part of engineering is science and empirical knowledge, and it's developed and carried in the minds of engineers. This is the stuff that you're familiar with. You know, Newton's laws of motion, Ohm's law, Faraday's laws, things like that, okay? And a lot of empirically derived stuff, because a lot of the time, science trails a long way behind engineering. So as engineers, we have to conduct our own experiments to figure out what's happening. The other part is technical collaboration, without which nothing would ever happen in engineering. Right? And it's very different from teamwork. Some of you may be experiencing teamwork in your courses, but what the data shows is that in engineering schools, teamwork is not taught. Because engineering academics, by and large, believe, why I don't know, they believe that you learn teamwork by practice. You don't. You learn bad habits just as well as good habits by practice. So as engineering, we don't teach teamwork, but we certainly don't teach technical collaboration. Now, I'm not going to tell you very much more about technical collaboration. Just please accept my definition and we'll go on. So essentially what it is, it's aligning human actions with the original technical intentions. And that can never be perfect. Just accept that. But the point is, we try to get sufficient alignment to achieve the predicted results. And that doesn't happen very often. Next. So here's a rhetoric question. You probably understand the answer straight away. What do we teach? Well, we teach engineering science. What do we not teach? Next. Technical planning and foresight. Technical collaboration, which is 80 to 90% of practice. We don't teach it. Right? That's why engineers are terrible at delivering results. Because you can't deliver results without that bit. And that's why everybody is frustrated with engineers around the world. Next. So here's a pictorial view of engineering practice, a different view this time. So essentially, the three foundations for effective engineering practice. On the right-hand side, we see engineering and business science, the technical knowledge. And I have to emphasize the importance of commercial knowledge, but if you have managed to learn engineering science, you can easily learn the commercial knowledge by reading books. It's okay, it's no big deal. On the left-hand side are the parts that seldom get mentioned: listening, reading, and visual perception. Many engineering schools claim that they teach communication skills. They don't. They don't teach communication skills. They teach you to give a PowerPoint presentation and to write technical reports. Very few engineers ever give a PowerPoint presentation. And most engineers write technical reports knowing that nobody else is ever going to read them. Right? They do not teach engineers to listen. What is it that engineers do by our own measurements? 25% of the time, they do this one activity more than any single other aspect of their work. 25% of the time they're listening. And most engineers are terrible at listening because they never got taught. So 25% of the time is wasted to begin with because most engineers do not listen properly. The last part is tacit ingenuity, and it's half hidden for a reason, because tacit knowledge is knowledge that we are not aware that we have. Like, for example, riding a bicycle. What is it that enables an engineer to look at something and say, that's wrong, going to fall down? That engineer, she has not had time to do any calculations like stress analysis or checking with queuing theory to figure out that that communication system is going to get congested with too many messages. That engineer has made an instinctive judgment based on years of practice and experience. That's tacit knowledge. And that is a crucial part of being a successful engineer. But unfortunately, in engineering schools, no attention is given to this critical capability at all. It happens by accident. It does happen quite well in some aspects by accident, but it could be a lot better. Now in the middle is the technical collaboration that I've been talking about, without which the scientific knowledge is useless. And then on top, the results. Three kinds of results for engineers. One on the right-hand side is achievement satisfaction. Wow. You see that funny little yellow bit right near the top? I designed that bit. That pride in achievement. But the other two are equally important. Client satisfaction, because clients will pay the bills. And at the back, reputation, because without a reputation, you won't get your next job. So these are the results of engineering. Next. I was talking a little bit about collaboration. Yes, next. Just to give you some idea, and I'm going to skip this very quickly, we expand that next. This is the kind of collaboration performances that I'm talking about. These are not simple. This is quite complex stuff, and it requires serious attention. Next. Next. Now, the top part is all about value creation. What do we mean by value? Next. Next. All right. Now, I can summarize a lot of research in this very simple slide. Talking about Paris and Tunis differences. Next. The engineering science works the same, happily. Water will not flow uphill here in Tunis any more readily than it flows uphill in Paris. Newton's laws of motion apply exactly the same. No problem there. Next. However, the process of getting effective collaboration between people is radically different. What you learn about collaboration in Paris will not work in Tunis, and vice versa. Right? And surprise, surprise, this is the bit that is not taught, which makes it even worse. Okay? This is the challenge. And effective engineers, and there are a few that we've discovered, somehow master it. Next. So now I'm going to have to go off into a bit of economics. Next. Might be more familiar to our government representatives. And there's some really good ideas that have come out of labour market economics. And you don't have to be a PhD in economics to understand this. Next. The first is, what is the cost of unpaid labour, times spent by women and children? It's a very simple relationship, which anyone can master. It's around about 2/3 of the local female earning rate. So go into a shop, find out what the woman is being paid. That will tell you the fundamental parameter, and then you can say, okay, if it takes 3 hours to do this job, that is the effective economic cost. This data comes from studies on hundreds of thousands of people in countries all around the world. It is the basis of many transport planning decisions. It's a very robust piece of economics. Carrying water 10 litres a person per day, that's what people need. 15 litres carried per trip, per person. That's what a woman can carry. A 1 hour round trip time, you can calculate what the cost of that water is. It's not rocket science. Next. Next concept from labour market economics is this. Wages, that is what you earn, is roughly proportional to the value that you add. Now, there are some important qualifications. Labour market constraints can affect this, regulation can affect it, unions, and the power of capital. So there have to be these qualifications, but it's a very useful relationship. Next. So if we look at this issue of low pay for engineers, are there labour market constraints on engineers? There's a surplus of unemployed engineers here in Tunisia, right? So there's no labour market constraint on employing engineers. Is there government regulation that decides what engineers shall be paid? Not in private companies, by and large. Do engineers get represented by powerful unions? Definitely not. We have a union in Australia, but they're apathetic. And what about the power of capital? Engineers don't have capital, by and large. We don't have money in our pockets, we spend other people's money. So what that tells you is that if engineers are being paid less, it is because they are contributing less. Very simple economics, right? Why do they contribute less? That is a more difficult question. But economics tells you that the value of what they're contributing is less. Now, in the course of my research, I came face to face with this reality because I discovered a small number of engineers in India and Pakistan, who, many of whom were working in government organizations, and yet they were being paid higher salaries than they would earn for the same work in Paris or London or the US. Yet they were in Pakistan. Many of them had never left Pakistan, never attended a grand école, right? So what was going on here? One of the things that we discovered is that they were thinking every day about the value that they produced for their employers. They were literally invaluable for their employers. Without them, the companies, the firms, the government organizations would have fallen apart and not been able to produce. That's why they were highly paid. They were highly paid because they were providing real value, but when it came to explaining how they were able to do that, they weren't able to explain it. So we had as researchers, that was an interesting challenge. Next. The third area I want to look at is economic development theory. This goes back a century to work to an Austrian economist, Joseph Schumpeter. Next, just keep on going. He observed step changes in economies of countries. Next. He attributed this to innovation. Next. So new goods, new production methods, next. New markets, new sources of components and materials, reorganization of industry. And he noticed, next, that credit is needed, finance, slack capacity, next. And he came up with this idea of the entrepreneur. Just go through this slide, next. Thank you, go back, right, thank you. So, this concept of an entrepreneur is deeply rooted in economics. Now, there's a big problem here. The entrepreneur is an innovator, a leader, right? Runs startup companies. But most engineers never do that. Most engineers work in jobs where innovation is strictly prohibited. You might think that if you're working in Paris, you get more opportunities to innovate than you do in Tunis. Think again. Most engineers in most organizations, in most countries, including industrialized countries, are not allowed to innovate. Why? Because it introduces too much technical risk and commercial risk. Like the power station. It's a big power station just along the coast from here, big gas-fired power station. I can assure you that the engineers working on that were not allowed to innovate. Right? So, now remember that relationship that salaries, wages, reflect value adding. Right? For labor market economists. Now, fortunately, engineers do get paid quite well. So the question is this, if they're not allowed to innovate, how can they be creating value? Economists say that innovation, entrepreneurship, is what creates value. But engineers don't do that, by and large. This is an interesting puzzle. And what it shows is that economists and business schools cannot explain why engineers produce something valuable. So with a colleague from Portugal, I set out to answer that question. And this is what I'm going to tell you next. So now we have to think about value and value creation in order to understand how engineers produce value. And once engineers do produce value, they get well paid. Remember that. Next. What does value mean? Well, for most engineers, this is what value means. The value of a variable. Unfortunately, here we're trapped in the English language, whether you like it or not. I'd be really fascinated to discuss this with you, to find out what these concepts are, or how to express these concepts in French and Arabic, to see whether it's different. But in English, we're stuck.
values
that was mentioned by the minister before. The same word gets used in lots of different ways. Well, that's one way of describing value, isn't it? Is this one of your banknotes? I hope this. I've got it off the internet. Sometimes I get embarrassed. Exchange value. So you think, okay, what's the bottle of water worth? How much it costs to buy that bottle of water, Aaron?
600.
Huh? 600. All right. So that's the value of the water. Wrong. Because if I'm in the Sahara Desert, all right, and I haven't got any water, I would pay 20, 30, 100 times as much to get a bottle of water. All right? The value depends on circumstances. Next. What is it? Well, one way of describing it is the acquisition of an artifact or an entitlement to a service. Next. This is what we call use value. And it involves emotions. Because it involves imagination, emotions. It captures the essence. Those of you who are in politics know this. You know that emotions are much more powerful than facts. Witness the election of Donald Trump in the US. Right? So what people perceive as value can be very different to what we as engineers think of as a quantitative value or as a cost. Next. It's subjective. If you need to each person, next. Depends on circumstances and time. And most important of all, it's co-created. Next slide. I'm going to illustrate this. You know, I have one of these in my pocket. Now, I could use it as a weapon to cause an injury to somebody in the front row. I don't think I'd get it as far as the back row. But there's lots of other things I could use to do that, right? This phone actually cost me quite a bit of money. So actually, I could only get value for that money if I learned to use it properly. So in other words, the value depends as much on how I use it as on the intrinsic value that was created by the manufacturer, Apple in this case. All right? So we have to understand that value is co-created. It is not just a function of what we engineer into an object, it's also a function of how people choose to use it. Next. So an engineering enterprise doesn't work on its own. Next. It works within what's called a value system. This is the theory that was advanced by Michael Porter in the 1980s. And we see here how different engineering enterprises all work within an ecosystem. And they're all mutually dependent on each other. You can't improve one enterprise without thinking about all the rest. Next. Next. Yeah. So this is, if you like, the foundation of how business schools think about value, or did until very recently. Each firm operates within a value system. The firm has multiple suppliers, products pass through channels, and the products provide channel value. Next slide. And here, this is the crucial point. The product exchange value is greater than the sum of the input exchange values. In other words, a firm is producing value if it makes a profit, by and large. That's basically what it means, that the costs are less than the money it makes in selling its products. This was the very simple idea of value that led to the global financial crisis, and even Michael Porter now understands that he got it wrong. And yet it is still taught as dogma in business schools today. Next. How do engineers create value? Well, if you read Michael Porter's book, which interestingly is based on almost no empirical evidence whatsoever. This is the big surprise. Here is a cornerstone of business science without a shred of empirical evidence. That shows you how ideas get floated in the world of business and economics. If we read his book, and his book actually is all about engineering enterprises, we do not learn anything about how engineers actually create value. Next. Next. These are the areas. Keep on going. Sorry, I keep on going till we get to the next slide, please. Yeah, we find engineers working in all these areas, but we don't understand what it is that they're doing. Next. So now we have to think about engineering value creation. So this is the core of what I've come here to talk about. And I'm going to summarize this rather quickly. Next. Thank you. Stop there. So when you read the literature, carry on the next one. When you read the literature, this is how engineers are thought to create value. Reducing human effort, reducing material costs, reducing energy consumption, design improvements, research and technology development. This is pretty standard stuff. Unfortunately, it doesn't explain very much because lots of engineers only do the first bit and do none of the second. Next. I call these efficiency improvements. So definitely engineers do create value by innovation, no question about it. And for some of you, that may be your career path. But the question happens, what happens if there's no innovation? Is it a case that little or no value is created? That, unfortunately, has become an understanding amongst engineers worldwide. An engineer said to me, after I interviewed him, he said, you know, being interviewed by you has been really helpful. Because now I understand that I'm like so many other engineers. I do no innovation, nothing technical in my job. And yet I realize that I am doing something useful. So this is a big challenge. Most engineers think secretly down here, why am I doing this? I'm not inventing anything new. My job is intrinsically dissatisfying because I don't have technical challenges. That is because we don't understand yet how engineers create value. That is why I'm trying to explain this to you today. Next slide, please. So this is a crucial concept which has emerged. Michael Porter has changed his position. Now he realizes that there is a thing called shared value creation. Why did the global financial crisis have such a catastrophic impact in the US? It was because companies lost sight of the need to develop their own communities. A company cannot survive without a healthy community, without well-educated people to work for it. And what we've seen in America is a collapse of communities. That's why Donald Trump got elected. Most people who elected him don't understand that he's not going to solve the problem. But at least Michael Porter has realized that he made a fundamental mistake 20 years earlier. Next. So in doing these things, reducing energy consumption, improving employee safety, health, skills, education, reducing material cost, recycling, reuse, reducing water consumption, emissions, environmental impact, and above all, building community respect and capacity, this is a crucial value creation exercise in engineering. But it is one of about 14 that we've identified. Only one of 14. Next. So here's a challenging example. Take an engineer who's a compliance engineer. He or she sits in an office, like a local government office, to decide whether buildings should be allowed to be constructed or not. Does no design work, simply checks designs done by other people, increases the cost and time. How does that engineer create value? Yeah, you could argue they're probably contributing to public safety, but if the building designs, as they nearly always are, have no problems with them, why have that engineer? Why not do the checking work in the company that produces the designs? Why have that external engineer employed by government to repeat work done by other people? This has to be answered because an engineer gets paid money. Next. So, this is my main answer. Engineers create value, first of all, because they create commercial and technical predictions and they build confidence for investment. Minister, sir, I know you have a relatively small budget at the moment, being Minister for Science and Research, right? But one day you'll be the Prime Minister and you'll have responsibility for a huge budget. And your biggest challenge is, can I trust the engineers to deliver? And most government ministers will tell you, no, I cannot. So one of the biggest impediments to capital investment everywhere is the lack of trust in engineers. Because engineers don't understand that their primary responsibility is to build that trust and confidence. So it means making predictions with an accuracy commensurate with the level of risk. Higher accuracy requires greater investment, and in the early stages of a project, a plus or minus 20% is enough. Forget about all those elaborate simulations. You can do the sums on the back of an envelope, but you better be sure that you're right. Next. This is a quick introduction to an idea called investor perceptions of risk. Now, you probably, some of you have done business, would be familiar with the idea that if a project is more risky, you have to get a bigger financial return. But there is another factor present here. What I've tried to show here is the personal point of view. A person will invest $250,000 in Australia, in fact even more, in building a house, because they see that as being a very safe investment. And yet when it comes to gambling and playing gambling on horses, it's probably not legal in this country, I don't know. They won't invest very much, typically $50, $100 on a horse race maximum. So there's a very important relationship. The amount of money that people are prepared to invest depends on the risk perception. Next slide. Now this is how many engineers see their projects. Very low risk. I've done all the calculations. It's bound to work. You see, very low on the risk perception scale, moderate in cost. Next. This is how the investor sees the same idea. Do I trust that engineer? No. Investing in engineers is inherently risky. So the investor's risk perception is way over on the right-hand side. And as you can see, the light bulb is way above the permissible line for investment, so the answer is no. I'm not going to invest. And the engineer gets so frustrated. He said, look, the net present value is positive. You're going to make money out of this. Sorry. Go away. Think of something else. A smart engineer does this. Next. A smart engineer works with the investor to gradually lower their perception of risk, to build confidence. And then something very surprising happens. Next. The investor actually is willing to spend much more than the engineer first imagined. Because the investor wants to make absolutely sure it's going to work. And so he's prepared to spend a lot of extra money making sure the engineer is properly supervised and has all the right materials. So once you get it right, then money is not an issue. I discovered that with the robot sheep shearing project. As soon as the farmers were satisfied that we could actually build a robot that worked, they gave us lots and lots of money. Money was not a problem. What was a problem was establishing the trust and confidence in the first place. Next. So just remember this. There's the engineer's view on the left, and there's the investor's view on the right. Next. And so in engineering, we see an established process which is used by large companies around the world. The same process everywhere, where you do a preliminary study followed by project definition followed by project implementation. And at each stage, more money is spent, there is more confidence. It is a confidence building exercise. We are building trust and confidence between the investors and the engineers. Remember, the investors have not the faintest idea what the engineer does. How can they? It's not written down very many places, only my book at the moment. Next. So reducing uncertainty. Many engineers see this as very unexciting. It's less challenging. You know, low-risk engineering is boring. You just follow standards. Right? You don't do innovation. You don't solve technical problems because that introduces too much risk. But in the process, you get more money to play with. Next. So this is the theory that I've come up with my partner Bill Williams in Portugal. In essence, what the engineer has to do is influence the perception of the investor before the money gets spent. So a lot of engineering is all about reducing the apparent risks by following standards, by making sure that there's rigorous checking, by making sure that there's reliable coordination, that the proper specifications in place, that above all it's based on past experience, that experienced engineers are involved to guide and supervise the whole process. It's all about providing reassurance and building confidence. And the next slide, and these are explained in the printed paper which I have available. The next slide is equally important, that is, what is the investor's actual experience when the money gets spent? So it's crucial not only to get the money in the first place, and then you can enjoy spending it. It's also very important to make sure the investor gets a good experience. And this is where things are going badly wrong. Next. So just go through this slide. I think we haven't got time to deal with it. I want to skip it. So just go through it quickly, please. keep on coming, coming. Yeah, I'm going to skip this because it'll take too much time. Keep coming. There's two slides. Another one. Skip this. Right, thank you. This is a photograph of a major engineering project in my estate in West Australia. It's not a unique project. There are many like this. It's a nickel refinery. Cost $2.5 billion. Next. Conceived in 2004 at a cost of $1.4 billion. The cost up to 2008, 2.6, sorry, these are Australian dollars, but they were very similar to US dollars. Sold in 2009 for $250 million. $2.4 billion of value destroyed. A catastrophic project, and yet it is one of many. Next. Success rate for projects between $100 billion and $1 billion. This is based on data on tens of thousands of projects worldwide. And the success criterion is that the financial return is better than 50% of what the investors expected. What sort of a success criterion is that? You know, if you make the figure 80%, the number of projects that succeed is so low that it's not worth doing the numbers. All right, so what is the success rate for projects up to $1 billion? It's about two in three. Success rate for projects over $1 billion, next. Oops, go back. Okay, I didn't actually put the answer on the slide. The success rate is 1 in 3. Projects over $1 billion. These are projects executed in countries like France, Germany, Japan, Australia, the US. In countries like Tunisia and Kazakhstan, the success rate is even lower. Now can you understand why corporate executives around the world are frustrated with engineers? Everywhere. 1 in 3 projects achieve a result which gives the investors at least half of what they expected. That is an appalling result. It is a catastrophe. And that is the reason why so many engineers are unemployed. Why? Because engineers are never taught to deliver results, and they're not taught about creating value. That is a challenge for educators. Now, for you as students, it's too late. You're about to graduate, right? Or you have graduated. How many of you have graduated now? So still quite a few of you, but I can assure you, you're probably not going to learn this in any of your classes, right? You have to read. I'm sorry, but the information is available. By all means, write to the organizers. They will provide you with copies of my paper. And there's a book. Next. Why is this important? Next. You want to earn 2 to 5 times as much as other engineers? Yeah? How many of you would say yes to that?
Yes.
Let's hear it. Right. So you've got to learn. You've got to provide sufficient value to your employers. You can use skills and knowledge that any engineer can learn, and this is how you can learn it. This is the promotion, by the way. Next slide. Okay, this is the book you need to get. Now, it's available on Amazon. Now, I know it's a bit difficult to get books on Amazon here. So, if there's enough of you who want to buy it, Ahmed here will organize for copies to be made available. It's going to cost about $25, but I assure you it's a very good investment. One of the chapters in the book is a comprehensive guide on how to get a paid job as an engineer. And so far, that method has never failed. But it's not easy, let me tell you. Under normal conditions, it's quite challenging sometimes to get a paid job as an engineer. So I would strongly urge that you get hold of this book. Next. This is a picture of wildflowers, just to show that I do things other than engineering. That's where I'd like to stop and invite questions from you. Thank you very much for listening carefully. Do we have time for questions, Mr. Chair? Maybe you might like to come up the front and then say the question into the microphone. It's all right, I won't bite.
Anybody wants to ask a question? So, Professor Tervanian, I have a question, maybe I can take the microphone.
Yeah.
I really loved your message about risks
and manage the real versus perceived. I think engineers are one of us very good at managing realness, but they're very bad, as you said, at managing perceivedness. How do they learn the skill of understanding what are the perceived risks and how they start to be able to manage them accurately?
Well, have we got this? Is this on? Okay. I think those of you in the front row, government ministers, members of government and so on, I think most of you have understood at least the basics. Right? This is not rocket science. There's no differential equations here. You just need to realize that there's some very useful concepts in economics, even in politics and philosophy, which can be applied here. So it's not difficult to learn, right? Once you have that perception, once you can see these ideas playing out in practice, then it's so much easier. So for those of you who are teachers, academics, engineering educators, there's a really good book called How People Learn. It was published in 2000, and there's a follow-up book by Susan Ambrose called How Learning Works. What those books tell you is that the key to effective learning is theory. Now this is very reassuring for us academics because we're constantly criticized by students who are saying too much theory, too little practical application. But you just need to understand that, let me explain. All right, most of you I think have learned to add up, all right, and do multiplication in school, right? And in order to do that multiplication and maybe division as well, you learned a technique. Okay? You learned a method for doing it. That method is based on number theory. That meant that you did not have to learn by rote the result of every possible addition, multiplication, subtraction, and division sum. You did not have to learn what 331 by 532 means. Right? You didn't have to learn the result by heart. You could apply a theoretical method which would work in all situations. That is the power of theory. The theories which I've shown you today are very simple in concept. You don't have to read economics textbooks to understand what they mean. You can apply them straight from this presentation, which I will make available, so I presume you can publicize it. All right? So you can learn this for yourselves. Once you understand that these concepts are important, you will see them playing out. And you can make a big difference. Politicians can do very little to advance the future of this country. I know, sir, you are trying. But I'm sure you'll be the first to agree that your effect is very limited. Because ultimately, all politicians can do is divide the amount of money available and to see who can spend it. Only engineers can increase the size of that pile of money. Only engineers. That's your job. Your job as engineers is to create productivity and prosperity so that governments have more money to spend on social welfare and education to produce a better trained generation of engineers, lawyers. Yeah, lawyers are important too, by the way. I don't want to downplay the effect of any of the other professions here. But engineers are particularly important. And please, please, remember water supply. Fundamental challenge. Fix that first and you will create an enormous boost to the Tunisian economy. Anywhere in the world. Well, the water is generally drinkable in Paris. It's not necessarily drinkable in Italy. There are many countries where the water cannot be easy, you can't be safe, be confident about drinking water out of the tap. Right? Mind you, remember that what goes with that too, we have an unfolding catastrophe in many countries where water is contaminated with bacteria, which is resulting in as much as half of all the children to be born today are actually permanently damaged from the year they're born. This will impose a huge cost on us all. It can only be addressed by you people as engineers. The future of the world is in your hands. Without your contributions, governments can do nothing.
Thank you very much, Professor. Thank you. We have one more question.
Thank you. we couldn't extend it further. How can an engineer in Tunisia create value for the country without the country? Because
okay.
The probably most of the students that they know, most of the Tunisians, they think in order to succeed, you have to go somewhere else. Can you just maybe extend that a little further, please? Thank you.
The question is, how can an engineer contribute value here in Indonesia? That's right, in Tunisia. Fix the water supply. Right? There's so many. I, as an engineer, I look around and I see there's so many opportunities here. But remember, the crucial thing is this. You have to deliver results reliably. So start with something small. Learn how to coordinate the work of tradespeople. The people who actually work with their hands, because without those people you can't deliver anything. Make sure you work out how to get them to produce your ideas in the way that you intended. This is a step-by-step process. Now, unfortunately, there is very little guidance here. So what I've written will give you a lot of insights into some of the challenges in India and Pakistan in terms of getting effective results from people. And some of the obstacles. For example, in India and in Pakistan, an engineer will have to work through two language barriers between herself and the people doing the work. So the engineer will think in English, in India will be thinking in English and Hindi. The supervisor probably speaks Punjabi, and the people doing the work probably speak Marathi. Three different languages. Now here in Tunisia, you have to work with Arabic, English, and French, right? But my guess is that the people who actually do the work speak a dialect of Arabic or Berber, which may be a completely different language, certainly in Morocco. So you have perhaps four languages to work with. And of course, lots gets lost in translation. Even if you only work in one language, an awful lot gets lost in translation. So you have to understand that this crucial ability for an engineer to produce reliable results is what then encourages people to spend money on you. Once they know that you can produce reliable results on a small scale, they will give you money to do things on a bigger scale, and then a bigger scale, and then a bigger scale after that. Focus on that. Produce reliable results. Eat every time, and every time it goes wrong, learn your lessons. Listen and learn.
Thank you very much, Professor Terrelli. Unfortunately, we don't have time for more questions, but Professor Terrelli has two breakout sessions this afternoon, so if you have any questions, please attend this session and ask questions. So now we have the coffee break, so please be back by 10 before 12, we're going to start at 10 before 12. So thank you very much again, and see you in 30 minutes. Thank you.